You can lose, but I know how you love to win. Break my damn down and pick me like a javelin. Whoa, you said we can't all be dumb. Bad news, kids.
Kyle was the guy that if you were in a band and played anywhere in Central or North Jersey, you know, like if you played places like Studio One, uh-huh, or Club Binet and the Saint and places like that, Kyle was the guy that you had to sell tickets for and bring back the money to. But if, you know, Trickster was pretty much already like on their way by the late 80s. Uh-huh. You may have narrowly escaped him.
Yes, we might have. But if it's another Kyle, he's still doing it, I think.
I think it's the same guy. I don't remember his last name, but you know, it was him, and he had two bouncers. We had a lead singer who used to bring in, you know, throw vegetables out and throw all kinds of shit on the stage. So as soon as we would walk into Club N.A., you know, the two bouncers would be on him, like right at the door. But listen, I have to talk about this news, man, that has come in over the last few hours. I'm sure we're on the same page when it comes to Eddie.
Yeah.
This news today that we've lost Eddie Van Halen to cancer at the age of 65. By the time this episode gets posted, you know, I'm sure the news will probably have run its initial course, but it's pretty much ripped a hole in, I'm sure, both of our days. I know you crossed paths and spent some time with him in the past. Is there any thoughts on Eddie or anything you might want to share before we get into anything?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's devastating. I mean, I had heard, you know, kind of in somewhat of a, you know, inner circle. So I'd known that he was, you know, really sick for a while. And then obviously it got out that he was sick, but they'd been really keeping it down low. And, you know, we knew that he'd been in the hospital for the last about month. And actually we got the call last night that it was sounding like they had told the family to come back. And I was like, oh man, like, this could be any minute. And before I could even, you know, I released my video today and I did a live podcast with Don Jameson. So I was busy all morning. And then before I could even blink my eye, I got the news. I'm like, oh my God, that was like so quick. But yeah, I mean, I was blessed to have been around him more than a handful of times. And, you know, Steve from Trickster, you know, he had become friendly with him, and I mean, he'd been to his house in Malibu, and you know, we became really good friends with Matt Bruck, who is, you know, basically runs EVH and was his tech back in the day. And so we have a lot of friends in the inner circle there, and again, you know, Ed and, you know, personally. So it's you know, although we haven't seen him or spoke to him in a good couple of years, it's still one of those things where, you know, I mean, forget the fact that we knew him on a personal, you know, basis to whatever degree, you know, is one of our childhood heroes, first and foremost, you know, and then tying the fact that, yeah, I mean, we did know him on a personal level. It was, you know, definitely cuts a little deeper, but man, it's just, forget that for a minute, you know, because the fact that he, you know, the fact that he's our childhood hero still overshadows that, you know? So it's, yeah, man, it's one of those things that they did such a good job at not letting it leak that it really came out of left field for everybody.
I'm surprised that, I mean, you said it so well, is that they've always been such an insulated band that nobody really knew what the hell was going on unless you really were on the inside.
Right.
I'm shocked, but not surprised. That type of thing, you mm-hmm. know, just to get, you know, because just knowing that he's been sick for so long, and he went through that first bout with it around 2004.
Right.
And when he was on the tour, he was smoking again, doing just really.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's been a long time he's been battling this.
Yeah, and he definitely put himself the ringer, because then he went even deeper and darker than that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, but he got it together over the last, like, kind of 10 years or so. And, you know, and then he's been battling for a good part of that. So,
mm-hmm.
unfortunate.
Yeah, it really is. It really just kind of just put a stop to everything today. Yeah. You know, I'm lucky my nephew was gone at the time, because we just done school. I'm doing online first grade. through most of the day. Yeah. And then by that time, so it was just kind of like, oh my God, and it just like stopped me when I, yeah. when I, cause I put my computer on to work and it was the first thing I saw. But anyway, Rock Under Fire, Mike DiRico here. I'm talking to PJ Farley, man, the resume, Trickster, Lita Ford. You're out there with Eric Martin of Mr. Big doing the big acoustic thing. I want to ask you about that later, but you have the solo albums out. You're playing with Jericho doing Fozzy. There's the Quarantine Project. You know, the resume is long, and it's mind-blowing.
Don't forget my Raw is a band I've been in for about 15 years now, maybe even more.
You're all over the place, man. And I mean, it's what impresses me more than the names that you play with and that you're associated with is the fact that, given the amount of time that you've been doing it, and all the changes that artists of your generation have either gone through, or just plainly died or disappeared from, you're still relevant, man. It's like you're still doing it in a way that is with dignity, with fucking class. The music sounds good. It's vital. It sounds current. You've been able to adapt to the changes in the industry over the decades. You know, you've navigated those changes from multiple directions in terms of musical styles. Are you just naturally one of those like chameleon artists where every color is already in you? Is like all of this music just second nature, or are you like pretty much like a sponge where you just kind of soak everything up that's around you and kind of let the influences seep in?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you for all that. That was really cool and a great perspective. Appreciate that. But I think, yes, to kind of agree with the fact that I love so much different styles of music and everything, and I have... You know, it's a true passion. So all these projects that, you know, I go and I play with, you know, I really genuinely enjoy. So I'm super blessed not to only get the phone call, but keep getting phone calls from bands and opportunities to play music that I really like.
Yeah.
And it's all great stuff, and it all kind of filters through me. So when it comes time to write for myself, I don't have to make a conscious effort to write like any sort of genre. I just kind of let the music do the talking, because at the end of the day, I got enough going on that I don't have to try to make a record to try to sound like anything, because I'm playing all different styles of music anyway. So I don't have to force it. Yeah, I'm letting myself just write what organically comes out.
That's one of the things that, I mean, you have this, it's an innate sense of timelessness, right? Meaning, Let It Rain, for example, I'm going to, you know, the first, is that the first single or the second single?
First single.
The first single off your album, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Which, in my opinion, is a fucking hit, man.
Thank you.
It's not just a hit. It's again, it has a sense of timelessness where I think it could have been a hit in any decade of the past 50 years. And it goes back to that thing we're talking about, where you're able to like transcend styles, literally live in that music, where you inhabit those songs, man, because it becomes so believable that it could almost fit in with anything, because it's already in you and you're not just trying to make a deliberate conscious effort to fit into any style.
Well, thank you. I mean,
that's an awesome thing. The new album is Accent to Change. You've referred to this album as an EP. It's got 9 songs on it, and I got to ask you, I'm 50. I think I've got a few years on you, but I know you're old enough to remember a time when 9 songs constituted an album.
Yeah, to correct you, I said that I was going to maybe do 5 or 6 songs and not call it an EP.
Okay, yeah,
because
I was
adamant about, you know, I'm against people putting that EP thing on a collection of songs that falls short of 10 or 14.
Okay.
Like those days are gone, man. We're back to selling singles now. You know,
I know.
If somebody comes up with 9 songs like I did, that's a record. If I came out with 7 songs, I was calling it a record. I wasn't going to dare let anyone call it an EP. Screw that. You know, I mean, that's a record. And I mean, I stand by that. I mean, I just so happened to kept writing past the 5-6 song hump. So I came up with 9, but yeah, I mean, five or six songs, I was like, I'm still calling a record.
Okay. I was mistaken then. I thought maybe you're like, well, I'm going to call it an EP because it maybe constitutes an EP in 2020 where everything has got 18 songs on it.
Yeah, no, I'm totally against that, 100%.
It's just a trend that began, I guess, I don't know when.
Yeah, the running time.
Began, you know, allowing time, you know, like the running time was like, this album is 60 minutes, you know, and then everybody started putting 18 songs on an album just because they could.
Yeah.
You've also described the album as a little more emotionally demanding than what you've been involved with in the past. And I'm talking Boutique Sound Frames too. I mean, both albums.
Right.
It's pretty much adult content. You know, they're songs that you couldn't have had the perspective of experience and the passage of time maybe to have written while, you know, maybe you were in your 20s or something. You know, maybe you needed the passage of time, maybe the sense of having years having gone by, some sense of having gone through hell to some extent. Some of the best music comes from pain, you know, and it doesn't necessarily have to be pure pain or anything like that. Anything that causes some sort of conflict or turmoil in our lives. I'll quote one of your songs, so I hope I don't get a lawsuit, but I'll quote a lyric. Why is it the best things in our life make us crazier than anything in sight? Just when you think it's okay, something along comes away, comes and blows it all away from the good life. Could you speak to that a little bit? In terms of having that passage of time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that song is about just what it says. You know, sometimes the best things for us are the very things that drive us the most crazy, but we love them, you know. But sometimes you got to say goodbye to them. And, you know, it's kind of one of those things, and you're right, you know, I don't think I would have written that back when I was writing Boutique Sound Frames. You know, so much time has passed in between writing that first record and this record. You know, a lot has happened. So, you know, in that respect, yeah, a lyric like that and a song like that came from, you know, going through a lot of changes and obstacles and, you know, having friends go through obstacles and trials and tribulations and all that stuff like that. So, and that all comes with time and, you know, adult content, as you say.
Coming out of the whole scene, that the whole hard rock, you know, there was a period in the late 80s where it was just kind of like, you know, everybody got lumped in with heavy metal, and hard rock, and it was just kind of like this fine line, and it was glam, and it was just kind of everybody trying to slap labels on it, and then everything just became, you know, the dreaded hair metal, you know, and just kind of I think what, when I use words like dignity, you've evolved in such a way that a lot of artists, I feel, either, I don't want to say use the word, maybe they're too ashamed to, or they just don't want to go in that direction, but a lot of people our age are still writing songs about getting laid, you know, they're just trying to, they don't evolve in that sense. It doesn't have that sense of perspective of time or the experience of adulthood where they're trying to kind of reconcile the partying songs with, you know, adding 20 years onto that. You know what I mean? I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. And, you know, I think I'm in an unfortunate position to where, you know, a lot of the people that you're probably speaking about, you know, have these kind of umbrellas that they have to kind of stick within, you know, whereas, you know, these solo records for me are my, you know, escape from the 10 bands that I'm in, you know.
Right,
and I just write whatever I feel. And it doesn't have to sound, you know, like anything that somebody's used to, because they don't know. I mean, now they have the first record as a reference, but I don't have to, you know, tailor the record towards any one particular sound. And if I want to, you know, if I want to, you know, write a song like, you know, My Reason, I write a song like that. If I want to write a song like, you know, Wait and Fade, I'll write a song like that. You know, nothing's off the table for me.
My Reason, obviously, about your kids, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a middle. I love the middle break in that where, you know, there's where there would normally be a guitar solo. It sounds like I don't know. I mean, I'm a musician. I'm a guitarist, but it sounds like a piano or a keyboard of some sort. Is that a little accurate, or what instrument?
Yeah, I mean, it is guitar. It's kind of designed to not sound like a guitar solo because it's more of like a just kind of like a bridge section and a pre-bridge section, so to speak. You know, because then the bridge comes after that, but there's piano in it.
Yeah, and you did almost a very similar thing with You Would Know. Almost in the intro, of that song.
Yeah, I think, you know, because I had that little riff, and I definitely didn't want it to be a guitar-driven riff. You know, I wanted a different sound, so I doubled it with a mandolin. And,
That's one of the many things I love about this stuff, man. You're not going in the predictable, expected areas, you know?
Right. And sonically, I wanted something different.
Yeah, and I mean they're catchy though. They're catchy as fuck, but the minor keys, man, they bring something out that the major keys don't. Like there's major catchy and there's minor catchy.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. They're catchy in a way that they don't become annoying 3 days later. You know, after like the third or fourth time you heard it.
You got to be careful with the major keys. They, you know, they very easily can be sucked into the hokey vacuum. You know?
That's what I was trying to say. But I mean, there's a lot of pops. There's a lot of modern pop sensibilities, meaning like, you know, it's like the melodies.
Right.
I'm thinking Chokehold, particularly the harmonies in that.
Right.
I know you did everything on the last album. But, I mean, do you do your own harmony vocals? Like, are you harmonizing with yourself, like, on top of the root note, or is that somebody else doing that with you?
Well,
because I'll tell you, man, like, among the strongest qualities of your solo work are the vocal harmonies.
Oh, well, thank you.
You know?
It's on this record, I was, you know, luckily, I didn't have to do all the harmonies. I did a bunch of them, but on Chokehold in particular, that's Steve Brown.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And then I had Sahaj from Ra doing some of the harmonies on it. But, yeah, I mean, I did a lot of it, you know, if not, you know, most of them. Harmony to me is crucial. You know, I mean, a good chorus with a good harmony, even verse harmonies, you know, I'm just such a sucker for them. You know, the Beatles, Jellyfish, Queen. You know, inspiration, you got to have it. I'm all about, although I'm a musician, I'm, you know, drummer at heart, bass player, you know, I play guitar, but, you know, at the end of the day, the vocal, you know, and the melody, the vocal is crucial, is the most crucial of everything. It's got to hook you and just sound really good.
This is true. Whatever happens, well, a little off track. Whatever happened to Jellyfish, man? I remember that. I loved them at their first album, and then I just totally lost touch with them.
So you mean some of you never heard Spilt Milk, their second record?
I heard of Spilt Milk. I've never actually heard Spilt Milk.
Oh my god! Oh my goodness.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
In my world, that's like saying you never seen Star Wars.
Yeah, I never saw Star Wars.
So you know, I almost envy that response because you're able to go and listen to that record for the first time now. And I'm so jealous of that because it's that much of a masterpiece.
You know what? I'm going to hold you to that, but I believe it. I believe it because, I mean, they were, the first album was, I was preaching that first album, but I don't know what happened around 90. Belly Button was like 90-ish.
90, 91, yeah. And,
but I don't know what happened after that, but I lost touch with them.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, maybe I was aware of it, but it just kind of just like fell off my radar.
Rediscover.
Yeah. And that's what happens to a lot of times. You know, I just rediscover stuff. Getting back to your writing a bit and adapting styles. And it's almost like, you know, you can adapt to a style and you can reflect a style, but almost kind of like you don't adhere to a style. And as an example, you probably don't get an album that maybe you don't get asked a lot about. Maybe you do. I don't know. You have co-production credits on an album called Undercovers.
Yeah.
In 1994. And it's this seemingly it's just this mix of songs by like AC/DC and the Beatles, Elvis Costello, Supertramp. I think you got there's a song by Paul Simon on there.
Yep.
You got a song like you're doing things like Nine Inch Nails, mm-hmm. the Beastie Boys. I started to say like it's unapologetic in a time right. where music was so defined. Like there was this, there was that, there was grunge, there was metal. You were this, and at some point you began writing for yourself.
Right.
You know, 2016 Boutique Sound Frames comes out. And let me just connect the two. And the reason I mentioned the covers album is because you never seem to have to be very conscious of what other people are thinking of how they define PJ Farley or how they define Trickster in the beginning.
Right.
You know, it's almost as if the covers album comes out within a few years of the first Trickster album.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, we like this. This is what we like. We do this, and we do this. And AC/DC is going to be right next to Supertramp, you know?
Right.
It's like, and fuck you if you have a problem with it. You
it's
know?
Always kind of been our attitude, really. I mean, it goes all the way back to, you know, us coming out wearing flannels back in the day. It was just kind of like, you know, I mean, we were very kind of just confident and self-secure. And, you know, for some fucking reason, I don't know why we were. I mean, we were so young, you know, and, you know, some would say cocky, but. We were kind of comfortable in our own skin and comfortable enough that, you know what, look, we thought at least back then that we were a good enough rock band with good enough high energy rock songs that we could just come out and wear fucking flannels in a time where people were wearing matching leather outfits and whatnot. And that wasn't going to hurt us or, you know, turn people away from, you know, looking at us or listening to us. You know, we just felt, fuck it, this is what we are. You know, and, you know, that's kind of an attitude that, you know, comes from all of us, you know, and, you know, obviously I'm part of that. And I've always maintained that kind of attitude. And it's never been, you know, back to my songwriting. It's always been, I never wanted to have to, tailor a certain song towards a certain genre. In fact, you know, back to your timeless comment, you know, I mean, like all the songs on Boutique Sound Frames were, you know, written so and recorded so long ago, and I sat on them for so long. But they, in my opinion, and the reaction that I got, you know, is that they all held up and people couldn't believe that they were recorded so long ago. Because they had that kind of, you know, well, this could have just come out today, like, and been written last month, and it's like, it works. On the contrary, you know, if I write something and it sounds like something that could be something else, like in a certain genre, I'm like, I don't like that. You know, I want to kind of have that undefinable kind of timeline.
Right, where it could be
anything can try to
place it in any decade or
right.
any time period. Or I was going to say, well, a lot of this stuff was, you know, and I wasn't aware of this, but one of my questions to you was going to be, have you always written for yourself? I know you have like co-writing credits on some, a bunch of things, The Machine, you know, Tattoos and Misery. Mm-hmm. But did you always write songs? And if not, at what point did you start feeling like, you know, going from not writing songs to suddenly, you know, at some point, sometimes when we put out, you know, albums, it's like vomiting, you know, it just like comes out and suddenly there's three songs one day.
It's definitely a muscle. It's a muscle. And I didn't really start getting into songwriting, like full songs until like, I would say about 90. It was a long time ago. It was like 92.
Gee, that makes
91,
sense.
91, 92. I mean, I was in. I was just not there yet as a songwriter, finishing songs and whatnot. I was always writing riffs and parts and stuff, and you know, contributing in that kind of sense. But it wasn't really until I really started honing in on singing and that's when I really kind of started vomiting songs.
Yeah. And I mean, there's no other way that we call it the vomit songs, because that's the way they just fucking come out.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can't stop it. It's just like you just wait until it runs its course.
Right.
You know? And then a month later, you know, you're bringing them to other musicians to record an album, you know?
Yeah.
But that the fact that your songwriting was that far back, man, I was going to say, like, you know, what happened at mid-decade here that made you realize that boutique sound frames had to happen? Like, why then?
You know, we had just finished, I think, the Human Era Trickster record in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you know what? Because going back to not wanting to tailor my songs for any sort of genre, I didn't want to do it for any kind of label either. So I wasn't writing these songs thinking, all right, this is the hit or this is the song. Label's going to love this. It was just the opposite. I'm like writing these songs and I'm like, I'm just doing them specifically for me. I'm not releasing demos or selling demos, and I'm certainly not trying to get a fucking record deal because I don't want to play that game. I had just been through the ringer with not only Trickster, but with Ra, too. I was signed to Universal Republic with Ra. And, you know, the game was just absolutely a mess, as it is now. But so, and there was no real internet when I was writing those songs. There was no cloud. There was no YouTube. So, you know, I was like, you know, I'm not going to try to get a record deal with this stuff, and I'm not going to just sell it out of my trunk of my car. I'm perfectly fine with these songs standing the test of time, and they'll come out when I'm good and fucking ready. And after we finished recording Human Era, I'm like, you know what? I think it's time. You know, while I'm still in the studio, I got a couple more songs. Let me bang them out, and now let me just put a collection of these songs out and put them out in the cloud, or I'll get somebody who just, you know, maybe we'll just handle the manufacturing and the distribution and just handle the headache for me. I don't care about money. I don't care about anything. The songs are done. Just somebody deal with, you know, the headache of selling it for me and just put them in the cloud and let people enjoy them. That's all I wanted to do with that first record, because I knew they were great songs, in my opinion. And that's all. So I got this label out of Australia to do just that. So, and then, you know, I made a couple of videos and I got a great reaction from it. And it was great. It was a good feeling. And it was a really good feeling, because I'm like, man, I mean, I think these songs are kind of timeless and they come out now, but I hope everyone else feels that way. So when I started doing press for the record, they're like, wait a minute, these songs were done almost 20 years ago or something? What? You know? I mean, so that was good to hear. And then, you know, I mean, the same thing goes for this record. I mean, I think my songwriting just kind of stayed along track with that and trying to keep in that timeless vibe. Because yeah. I never knew. I wrote a couple songs. I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to do a record. I just wrote a song. I recorded it. I'll see what I'll do with it. I wasn't committed to making a record this time around either. And then the more I wrote, I'm like, all right, I guess I'm doing a record.
Yeah, if you accumulate a certain amount of material, it's like, well, here's an album.
Yeah.
But then again, a lot of things just don't feel as cohesive as some other things do. This one, I mean, it works, you know, it definitely works, as opposed to just a collection of songs, you know, because that's another problem with some of these albums that come out today, where you have 70, 75 minutes on an album, which is supposed to be a single album as opposed to a double album, you just lose the cohesion. There's no linear feel to it. There's just these songs are all over the place. And, you know, consequently you have like where you critics, you know, it almost sounds cliche, but where, you know, critics always used to use words like uneven.
Yeah.
You know, this is an uneven effort from so-and-so, but you know, now it's really uneven because there's so much fucking material that it's just like this. There's a reason some of the shit was left off of certain albums.
Yeah. And I get it. I always say trim the fat, man. Give them less, not more.
Yeah. And
especially nowadays, you know, they're not really, people aren't built the same way. You know, they're not listening to Use Your Illusions 1 and 2. They're listening to records like mine, 35 minutes and like 42 seconds.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's it. On to the next one. Even if they get through all that, you know, and that's why I put, I you know, sequencing is a big thing with me too. And the feel of the record and the ride that it takes you on. So I kind of,
I'm coming from the same school, man.
Yeah. And I came out with, you know, I knew I had a little bit of, you know, as my first record too was had some, you know, kind of mid-tempo-y stuff. And, you know, some people would say, oh, I wish your record was a little faster or whatnot, you know, which I respect that, but I certainly wasn't going to change that or write to force that. But I did kind of give on this record, it's got a little bit more gas in the front.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then the depth in the middle. And then I kind of come in, land the plane a little bit towards the end. And I put two of the slower songs at the end. Meaningful, important songs nonetheless, but I figure, hey, if you don't get the patience for it, you sat through most of it. Cheers to you.
Right. No, I'm more interested in what the artist's intention was, you know, the artist's initial and final vision for any particular project is, as opposed to what I want as a fan, because that's just my own selfish reasons as a fan to, you know, like, I wish he would have done this, or I wish you know, to walk away bitching from something as opposed to enjoying it for what it is and seeing it for what it is.
What it's supposed to be, right?
So, yeah, I totally get that, man. What was I going to ask you? I totally lost my fucking train of thought. but seriously, like, if you, double albums, for example, if you look at the history of double albums, and there's a lot of great ones, you know, you hear those words like, you know, this is like physical graffiti is Led Zeppelin's sprawling flawed masterpiece or this or that, you know. And then we hear about people like, well, you know, it would be much better if it were a single album. And that's true for a lot of albums.
Yep.
How many times have you been asked, or just you thought of this on your own, or is it maybe I'm just a music geek that thinks about these things? You know, take the Beatles' White Album and trim it down to a 12-song single album,
yeah,
because it was 1968 and the songs were smaller, you know, shorter in time.
Yeah,
you know,
they were. I mean, the Beatles did it right, I think. You know, I mean,
yeah,
they get a pass.
Yeah, they get a pass. There are, or something like, you know, then there's, I don't know, you know, you Fleetwood Mac, you know, a single album that they put out was Rumors, but it becomes their biggest album because it sold 150 billion copies, you know, and every song on it is probably on the radio right now as we speak.
Right.
But Tusk is, you know, the better album because it's supposed to be the brilliant one. And, you know, the Rumors is the divorce album. You know, Tusk is Lindsay's Nervous Breakdown album.
Right.
You know, and then the critics will say, well, it's, you know, it's Sarah and 95 minutes of Lindsey Buckingham vomiting, but it's a flawed masterpiece. And if it were
right,
only one album, it would be great, you know.
Right.
But you mentioned Trickster right before Boutique Sound Frames and that album. You must get asked a lot about Trickster.
Sure.
Is it going to happen again? Was I don't know if it was, if I heard it wrong, or was 2020, was something going to happen with them in 2020, or were you talking about doing something?
Well, it was before the 30th anniversary of our first record. So, of course, you know, Steve and I would have loved to have, you know, been out there celebrating that in some way, shape, or form. So, I mean, the beginning of the year, we were toying with some sort of idea. We had really no solid plan, but, and then before we knew it, that was all shit in the bed.
You're telling me, man.
COVID game, put that right back to bed.
Yeah. What happened to you? Did you get some kind of like a false positive or something? And then you found out that you were a little iffy on whether or not that was even accurate. Like what happened there?
Well, no, I got, I was going on the road with Fozzy and, you know, we were going to play Sturgis. We were going to do a bunch of shows, and, you know, it was controversial. So I'm like, hey, guys, you know, let's all get tested before we get on the bus together. You know, make sure the bus driver gets tested. This way, if anyone has shit to say about us traveling together in a tour bus, we can say, well, we all got tested. We're, you know, clean bill of health. And at that point, I hadn't been anywhere in 5 months. So, I mean, I went, got tested for shits and giggles, really just to show everybody, and it came up positive. And I'm like, that's just impossible. 9 days later, I got my results. So, You know, but then my wife got tested negative. I came home after that tour. I tested negative. I went out, did a couple shows with Eric Martin, came home, tested again, negative. And then I would say just about over a month after I had tested positive, I got the antibody test, and that was negative. And anyone who I'd been in contact with got tested, and everybody was negative. So I certainly did not have it.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's a real thing. It's a real thing both ways. It's a real thing that I know the disease absolutely exists.
Right.
But there are a hell of a lot of false positives.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a number.
Wow. I do want to ask you a few more things, but speaking of the whole pandemic thing, walk me through quarantine. How did that happen? How many Kiss songs did you guys actually record?
Well, it started with Kent, the drummer. He's Luke Bryan's drummer, but a massive Kiss fan. And his friend Joe McGinnis, who plays in a band called Classic 78. It was an amazing band that writes songs that sound like Kiss from the 70s.
I know it. So I love it.
Yeah, they were doing, yeah. They were just kind of messing around. They were going to kind of record No, No, No. So Kent sent a clip of him playing the beginning to Jericho. And he goes, hey, name the song. And he texts back. He goes, no, no, no. You guys need a singer? You know? And he was like, well, actually, come think of it, we were just going to try to do this and put it up on YouTube, but you want to sing again. Plus, we need a bass player. So Chris, I mean, I've known Chris for years, and we're really good friends. So, I mean, he instantly thought of me because they had picked No, No, No and Heart of Chrome. And also tie into the fact that I toured with Kiss on the Revenge Tour. So it all made sense. And then before we knew it, we had a, you know, top 25 hit at rock radio with No, 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 with Bruce Kulick in the band for Heart of Chrome. And we have another one recorded waiting to come out. And then we have a fourth one chosen after that. So, yeah,
nothing,
we're still
nothing you're revealing at this point.
Nothing I can reveal at this point, but it's definitely something fun. It's a pet project. Just celebrating the Bruce Kulick era of Kiss with Bruce Kulick sometimes.
Okay, cool. I stuck with Kiss to the 80s, man.
Yeah.
It was a dark period, but it was a fun period.
Well, it's ironic that one of the bands that, you know, got so big because it was a band you couldn't look away from.
Yeah.
You know, turned into a band that you couldn't look at.
Well, they wore more makeup when they weren't wearing makeup.
It was just tough to see Gene struggle in some of those outfits. That's all.
I mean, I'm sure you've lived, I mean, you've been on three sides, and you know the Maud jokes, you know, where
yeah, exactly.
Gene looks like
yeah.
Maud.
And you know, I mean, obviously Paul, you know, embraced it to the, you know, fullest level, and he wore it as well as anyone could have in that day. You know, the rest of the guys weren't so. It was Gene really. Bruce said it the best in the behind the music. You know, those were tough times for Gene, you know, the demon trying to wear a big pink overcoat and, you know.
It was just totally across the board with Gene. And I love Gene. I mean, look, I've been a Kiss fan since 1976. We've all been Kiss fans since the 70s. We're all pretty much the same age. And we've earned our right to make fun of those guys, man. So I'll say it, you know, Gene was like what Paul says, you know, in his book, and it's just by all accounts, Gene was just not on board in the 80s.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had his movie career fine, you know, but it was Paul, man. Paul fucking carried them through the 80s.
Well, Paul lit up in the 80s, man. You know, he was like, he was showing his face, he was doing his thing, and, you know, he was,
He was the front man. It was his band, you know. Yeah. It was clear, you know. And every new album that came out, it seemed almost for whatever reason, it always seemed like their albums came out every September for a while there. And I remember this year's album was Lick It Up, and then it was Animal Eyes and Asylum. It was like the beginning of every school year was a new Kiss album. But the majority of those songs, I mean, this is what you guys are now doing. you know, quarantine is bringing this stuff into the 21st century, man. And it was fun
kind of, you know, rediscovering, you know, doing the deep dive back into that stuff, because I had forgotten about a lot of it. But I mean, it was very interesting to go back to that and, you know, really see how intricate the stuff is, like crazy. Like with Eric and Bruce just changed the foundation, rocked the foundation of that band into another level. So, I mean, it was really cool. Like I said, rediscovering it.
I remember watching Bruce play some of his solos. This was on when Bruce and Bob went on the Kiss cruise a few years back with them, and Bruce was on like for a few years. But there was one year where Bruce went on stage and he did a medley of all the
right.
these things,
mm-hmm.
and I mean he spent like 90 minutes playing this stuff. But even Bruce seemed a little bit like, oh, my God, this stuff was like he had to relearn his solos. And he was like, what the fuck was I playing? It's like this stuff is hard. And my hand cramps up. You know, I get like I can't play. I had to stop playing guitar playing in bands because I couldn't do the shows, you know, doing cover bands in 3 hours a night
right. In
bars. My hand would cramp up. So I can only imagine like still playing that long. And playing some of that stuff and learning replaying that stuff note for note. I'll Fight Hell to Hold You and all of those songs, just Crazy Nights album alone, man. Holy shit.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you guys are doing this project.
It's getting a great reaction. People are loving that we're celebrating that.
You're not doing Burn, Bitch, Burn, are you?
No. Not that I'm aware of.
Good. But, you know, To Gene's Defense, though, I mean, and the album that gets trashed and is The Elder. And I really think that Gene shines on that album. Gene owns that fucking album. It's an album that I wish they respected more. It's something that they should be proud of and not embarrassed of. I don't know how you feel about it, but it's just...
Yeah, I'm mixed about it.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong. You know, you were supposed to be doing a fall tour with Fozzy that got canceled.
Mm-hmm.
And, but you managed, you know, obviously managed to do some shows here and there. You're currently doing dates with Eric Martin now?
Yes.
Okay. So those shows are on.
Yeah. We have, I mean, luckily we have, you know, what we're doing is acoustic. So it's more conducive to the 6 feet apart tables, masks, you know, that kind of environment. Whereas, you know, like Fozzy, you know, we go out there and it's a rock show. We want people right in our faces, and you know.
Yeah. Have you guys been able to do that, or that's just not happening anytime soon, or what's
going on? No, I mean, we got a couple of shows. We did about a week of shows in August, and, you know, the fall tour got pushed to April.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, that's why it's probably best to do it then, you know, hopefully it happens. But, you know, with the acoustic thing with Eric, you know, we get up there and we're not making them dance and mosh around. So, I mean, it's like you can sit and you know, it's kind of a storytelling kind of thing. And it is what it is. So
I mean, just like the future of the whole concert thing is just at this point, is it just all dependent and hinging on a vaccine at this point?
I don't know, man, because so many people are like, fuck that vaccine. I'm not taking that.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true.
I mean, so many people are, well, when COVID goes away, it's like, well, COVID's not going away.
It's not going anywhere. Man.
You can get vaccinated. You can get vaccinated and it'll go away. Or, you know, look, there's a lot of unanswered questions. People are going to say, you know, is it going to get mandated because you're putting people at risk? Or is life just going to be like this from now on?
Yeah.
So it's hard to say. And that's a whole other conversation.
This is true, man. I think I just kind of think it's here. It's something that, you know, we get used to, man. It's just something you live with.
Yep.
I hate to say it that way, but it's, you know, I hope I'm wrong, man.
Yeah,
but,
we'll get it together.
Yeah. I know there's one show coming up in Teaneck that's scheduled for early December.
Right.
That would be great if I could get up there. I would like to get up there. I know my co-host, Pat, would want to come out for that because he was, you know, a fan back in the day, and he actually he wanted to do this show. He couldn't get off of work. Anyway, man, the album is Accent to Change. PJ, it's been great talking, man.
Likewise, man.
I thank you for your
doing
time.
The research and listening, and you know, great questions, and appreciate that.
Best of luck with the album.
Thank you.
You know, seriously, man, these days, best of luck with the album. Best of everything in the future.
Right.
It's been great talking to you, brother.
Thanks, man. You too, bro.
Take care, man.
13 December.